The Anton Savage Show
with Kearies.ie
on News Talk.
It is the Anton Savage Show. With me is Saoirse Hanley, who's feature writer with the Independent, and Tanya Ward, Children's Rights Alliance Chief Executive, looking through the news breaking today. And we start with that protest outside the Taoiseach's home. Saoirse, he had been critical of other people having protests outside their home. We saw Roderick O'Gorman, we saw the bomb scare with Helen McEntee's, and of course he referenced his own experience with it many years ago. He now has experience with it again. Protesters is probably the wrong word. Agitators, I guess, outside his house in the evening, as he describes it, as his kid's bedtime.
Yeah, and I think your point there about saying agitators, like, is something he seems quite strongly about too, that in everything that kind of everyone has reported that he said, he cautions calling them, you know, protests at all, because he, you know, I think this seems to transcend to a whole other thing for him. And I think what's scariest about the story is just that he wasn't even there, that it was just his wife and young children, that they said it was bedtime, and that, you know, it's something that he seems hesitant to talk about much at all, which I'd imagine is because it's quite terrifying for, you know, especially as a parent of young children, to have, like, to face up against that. But as you said, it's the latest in a string that I don't really know what you're supposed to do about that. Like, how, you know, I guess all you can do is just have people, you know, moved away from there, but how do you encourage people to stop turning up outside a politician's home? Because what does it achieve, I suppose?
I suppose to some extent it achieves what they want, which is attention.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I am very worried about what's happening when it comes to politicians, because one of the great things about Ireland is you can actually run into your politician and have a conversation with them, and they're very approachable. And we're a small country and we need to manage and safeguard that. It can't only be elites that have access to politicians. Ordinary people should be able to talk to their politician. But what we're allowing to happen in this country by allowing these kind of, and it's not pro, it's harassment actually is really what it is. Because also Paul Murphy had a death threat against him this week as well. You know, it's about effective policing. Because even Harris this week said, I asked, you know, the commissioner, do they have enough law to deal with this? He says, yes, we do. So it falls back on the police and how they're dealing with it. But I do hope people make the connection, because absolutely, Simon Harris's children, the Taoiseach's children, should not be harassed in this way. But we also need to make the connection with the kind of protests that have been going on around some of the refugee accommodation centres. You know, those images in Ross Cray of protesters and children having to be walked past them, and it was quite terrifying. And even some of the people protesting were very disturbed by it. They realised the children were very disturbed by it. That should never have been allowed to happen, to be honest. And I hope it begins a new conversation about legitimate protest and what that looks like, and the line we're crossing in terms of harassment, because it is going to change the nature of politics if it's not being dealt with effectively.
Because it also means, like, especially changing the nature of politics, like, if you think about, like, a possible chilling effect that could happen, the amount of people that would be turned off going into politics at any level, because that's not something that anybody wants to have to contend with. But it is a good point about, like, legitimate forms of protest, because there's protests every single day about, you know, a variety of causes. And I think that having to decide what a protest actually means and what it then achieves is an important kind of line in the sand to draw, because otherwise it does fall into, like, a harassment territory.
And how do you draw that line?
I don't know. That's the difficult thing. It's hard as well, I think, because especially when there's topics that are so emotive for people, like, people are very passionate about these things. And, you know, I'm thinking at the moment about, like, you know, large scale protests we're experiencing at the moment. So you've got a lot of, like, pro-Palestine protests. You've got a lot of, like, anti-immigration protests. And it's one thing for me, who believes a certain thing, to say, well, one is right, one's wrong. But for people who believe otherwise, like, how do you tell them that their form of protest is wrong? So I think it is just trying to figure out the line of what is harassment. And I think the personal home aspect definitely does draw a bit of a line like that, because, you know, that's how can you call that a protest? Yeah. What is, you know, like you said, it's achieving attention, but it's surely the wrong kind of attention, you know.
Yeah. And you can imagine what's going to happen now with politicians. It just so happens that the Taoiseach and the Minister for Justice are young politicians and they have young families. You can imagine politicians thinking, or people entering politics, I'm going to wait till my children are a bit older, because I don't, like, young children would be very affected by that. Those kind of events would have an adverse effect on they'd be afraid to leave the house after it. So I do think it falls back to, we need to have a bigger conversation, and the guards need to look at how they're doing policing in these kind of areas. And it's a bigger piece around.
But does that mean arrest the people outside the houses?
Well, they have different ways of dealing with these kind of situations. And it's obvious that the way they're doing it at the moment is just not effective. It shouldn't be happening, to be quite honest with you. And it hasn't happened in the past in Ireland. Like, if we want to create that openness between the ordinary Irish people and our politicians, we have to make sure that some of them who want to harass them aren't allowed to do it.
But by doing what?
I mean, I think you have the guards have other things. They've cautions, fines, different things. They have different ways of dealing with it. They don't just have to arrest people and put them in prison. They can fine people for doing different things under the Public Order Acts. That's the kind of stuff that needs to be looking at.
And do you think there is a reason why they're not, Saoirse?
I think because there is a large, I suppose, voice that feels that they have a right to say what they want to say. And I think sometimes when that is cracked down on, the same people can feel like they are then being silenced or not being allowed to quote protest in the way that they see fit. I would imagine that's, you know, part of it too, that it is kind of a, you know, but again, it's interesting because, you know, the guards can shut down a lot of other things quite quickly. So you do wonder you know, stopping them from shutting that down. Because I'm wondering this, like in reading about the kind of, because there's been such a string over such a short amount of time. Like, I was working on a piece during the week and I mentioned some of these, like, you know, people gathering outside politicians' homes. We'd gone to print and then this came out again. And I was like, how can this again have happened in the last, you know, hour? But I suppose it's just, I feel like arresting people at the scene could, you know, embolden people to think, well, you know, this now is transgressing against our right to say what we want to say. So I don't really know
what
to do.
I mean, it that sounds like Hobson's choice.
You can have limitations. Yeah, you can have limitations, you know, that kind of way.
Yeah.
And like, you could, loads of other places in Ireland to protest. You can attend to the outside the Dáil and protest, and the guards will allow you to do it. There's lots of other ways to do it. But outside someone's home where there are children living, families living, other people within the community living, it's not legitimate. It is verging on harassment. And I think they should be looking at using fines and things like that to deal with it.
Is it a matter of like guard presence being, you know, there? But then do you have to have someone stationed outside a number of politicians' homes at all times? Like, that then is another kind
very
of...
Very expensive to do that.
Yeah, and also still quite scary for people in the area or children in the house or any of that. Like, that's another kind of an expense, but also an emotional expense too. So I honestly don't know what you're supposed to kind of do to grapple with it.
The other thing that links to this then is there's a report in the Indo today saying that the Twitter posts relating to these kind of... fomentation of aggression outside people's houses and some of the protests related to immigration, that about 80% of those posts on X are from outside the state.
And when I first kind of saw that, I think the number is staggering because 80% is huge.
Yeah.
But when I kind of dug into it, it didn't surprise me too much because I was, the same piece that I was working on, I was looking at a couple of different, what kind of posts get served up on social media if you kind of have a blank account. So I just wanted to see how long it would take for different things to appear.
Yeah.
And a video that came up quite quickly was a clip from a podcast with two Americans, and they were discussing the riots in last November, and they were talking about the Irish people, you know, quote, standing up and doing what, you know, they said, like, oh, it put the likes of like the Black Lives Matter protest to shame. They did so much more. They were, you know, they're really standing up against this kind of influx of immigration. And they were just talking about this in a real kind of celebratory, congratulatory way and saying that Americans should be following suit and all this kind of stuff. And I think that the fact that it's even made it to some, you know, random podcast clip that's circulating on YouTube Shorts, it does point to the fact that it is in conversation elsewhere, which I think because we're so involved in it here and we're so, you know, we're dealing with so much of it on our shore, like trying to figure out how to deal with that, that we forget that everyone else is talking about it too.
Yeah.
But 80 is staggering.
The only thing I'd say is anything you see on Twitter now, you just can't trust. Because what's happening is these kind of messages are being amplified by the algorithms because they're all trying to retain people on as long as possible. The more extreme messaging is being pushed ahead. Anything moderate or reasonable isn't being pushed ahead by the platform. But the other thing is the manipulation of it as well. There's a really good podcast out at the moment. It's Who Trolled Amber Heard? And basically it looks at, during the whole Amber Heard trial, it's very similar stats are shown. So what happens is it's all manufactured. Basically, there's people in other countries being paid money to do fake tweets, essentially, and do it all day, every day to make sure they trend. And then ordinary people in the country then connect with it, think, oh, this is a massive thing. I mean, sometimes I see the numbers myself and go, how do so many people care about Newman Kennedy? Like, you know, this is a small local protest. Why are there 53,000 posts in one day? And that's what gets picked up in The Independent. So I just think we can't trust what we're seeing on Twitter. I think behind a lot of this stuff, I do think there's some manipulation outside. And after hearing that podcast, who trolled Amber Heard, and realising, you know, one person can just throw money at something and you can manipulate Twitter in that way, I don't think any of us should trust it anymore.
There is a lot of obviously underlying tension in relation to asylum. This was the week that we have seen significant action taken in respect of things like the tented villages. Although it seems, Saoirse, that we are still getting people putting up tents wherever the opportunity arises. A park in Balls Bridge now has a tent set up there.
Yeah, I think it's a consequence of you know, the kind of tent space on Mount Street being kind of cleared up and cleared away. Is that, you know, I think 200 or so asylum seekers were brought elsewhere, but anybody that arrived after that fact or after that point has been told there isn't any. So people have arrived in, and I think there's one story, I think it might have been in the Examiner, they were talking about somebody had been staying with a friend for a few days and left their tent on Mount Street, and when they came back the tent was gone, their friends were, or anyone they'd met was gone, and they said, well, where do I go? And they said, well, there's no space, everything's done. And it seems to be that there's nowhere else to go, and there was a few tents set up in that park, and I think that the church that's nearby had come out in their, they'd been quoting the Daily Mail saying that, you know, that they can't do much, that it has to fall to back to the state. But it seems a little bit like they've managed to thankfully give these people shelter, but that is it for the moment. But then there's still countless people that will still be turning up at the site and on Mount Street, and will have nowhere, we'll be told they have nowhere to go.
And there's an interesting breakdown in the figures of where those people are coming from, Tanya. This thing of whether they're crossing the border and arriving by land or arriving in through ports.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about it is, you know, in the news coverage, there's been a lot of interviews of people outside Main Street, like, where did you actually come from? And there's one or two, you know, that came from the UK, flew into Belfast and arrived and got the bus down. But actually, a lot of them are actually coming from other, and countries you would expect, countries like Afghanistan. And they've crossed Europe. There was a story of one man where he said he nearly died on a ship getting to Italy. And then he made his way to Cherbourg, and they spent 10 attempts trying to get across, had to pay traffickers who, he said, aren't very good, nice people. And you can imagine what they're doing to people in the Cherbourg region. Eventually gets on a ship and spends 5 days without any water, any light, and eventually gets out down in Wexford and makes his way up to Dublin. So they've been through very difficult, traumatic circumstances. And if you leave somewhere like Afghanistan, where the Taliban are oppressing people, you can imagine what's happened to them before they even made this journey. So I think what's coming through is it's a little bit more complex. You know, yes, there would seem to be some people travelling from the UK through Belfast down to the south, but a lot of people are coming through other ways as well. They might have had documents that allowed them to get in through Dublin Airport and declared and looked for protection sometime after, you know, a few weeks, spent some time on someone's bed or couch before they went and applied for protection.
But the breakdown in the Indo has 91% of people arriving, the first that they show up is at the International Protection Office in Dublin.
Yeah, but that doesn't tell you that, and they actually travel through Belfast. I mean, there's an assumption that they've travelled through the north, I think, but that's not actually the case. If you look at some of the media coverage today, all the interviews that took part with all the people outside the IPO, some of them did and some of them didn't. I mean, I think while you're seeing some movement, it's not just because of the Rwanda policy.
But what government officials are being reported as saying is that that is almost entirely across the land border.
Well, that's what they're saying, but I'm just not so sure that's correct. I mean, there's assumptions being made, and I mean, I've heard other figures earlier last year. They were saying 70%, but unless they have real documentation about how people arrived in, I'm sure it's significant enough for them to say it. But I'm not so sure that it's fully correct, to be honest, and that borne through some of the media coverage from this weekend.
Because even if like you're saying, they're talking about the figure in the Indo saying that. And then there's also, like, you know, on the same page, stories from Catherine Fegan talking to people who have arrived in one of the sites in, I can't get the name of it now, the site.
Cuxling, is it?
Cuxling, yeah. And it's interesting that a lot of the human stories coming out of it don't match the stats, which is interesting because, you know, that's what is being reported from the government. But, you know...
Although it's a very small sample size. I mean, if you look at 10,400 people of last year, three or four human stories is an infinitesimally small sample size.
Well, this is true, yeah. So it kind of can't reflect that, but...
The other news then today is RTE finally, it appears, well, not finally, it has an interim solution to its funding problem.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've had this conversation about the funding of RTE on this show before. And what's coming through now is finally a settling, government starting to settle on what's the model going to look like into the future. And it's clear Micheál Martin's in the background pushing, understanding we need an independent broadcaster. And we need independent broadcasting because I think this is bigger than RTE.
Well, he's pushing licence fee, isn't that it?
Yeah, he's basically saying let's lower the licence fee. Let's get revenue to collect it. So I think lowering it would make it, you know, politically palatable. Revenue to collect it, no one would like that, but they're very good at collection. So I think that seems to be a good solution. But also the government actually providing funding to RTE and for other broadcasts, including, I'm sure, News Talk. And there's also seems to be local media providers who also want to get some public broadcasting funds to do their own kind of work in that way. That all sounds to me the right way to go into the future, especially in the world of myth. Because you need independent broadcasting.
But why fund it that way?
I think having the public fund it directly means it protects it, I think, into the future, to be honest. Because if you look in...
But this isn't that. What they're talking about is a hybrid model where they do both.
Yeah. But the licence fee at this moment in time, it's not... We don't have enough people paying it. Our population isn't big enough to actually fund public broadcasting. I think that is the fundamental problem. In the UK, the BBC has many more licence payers that can fund it. We don't have that in Ireland. And
but we'll be funding it either way, surely.
What was that?
We'll be funding it either way.
Yeah, I think that's... But I know you're right about that. But I think with the public kind of contribution to it, as well as the revenue at the same time coming in as two streams, you can imagine a future government trying to undermine public broadcasting by cutting funding. But so by having a public element, it gives us some level of protection. But the other thing is...
But would they not be able to do that on both lines? So they could reduce Exchequer funding and they could also reduce the licence fee because the licence fee is in their gift. They'd still have power over that.
It's a lot more work to do, I think. And I think optically, like, it's a lot more work to do if you start messing with the public licence fee. But the other thing that's important about the message here is it's not funding without strings attached. There's some very good recommendations coming down on governance and culture change, and also about how they're using public funds. There'll be no flip-flops into the future, to be honest. That's what's coming through. And I think that's all very welcome. I think the Irish public are done. They've had enough of this. They just want the politicians to sort it. And they want the kind of situation that was happening in RTE with the lack of transparency, the lack of governance, the culture issues. They want all that dealt with.
Although, oddly, what we were faced with, Saoirse, was a choice. It was going to be either it'll be funded directly out of the public exchequer or it'll be a return to a variant of the licence fee, like a media charge. The answer to either or now seems to be both.
Both, yeah. But I think, like, involving the licence fee is going to be tricky regardless, because I think that the question's always going to be about collection. Like, I think at this point, before any of the RTE kind of finance scandal broke, there was already a huge problem with trying to collect the licence fee and people just not paying it. And I think now...
Before the scandal broke?
Like, before the scandal, there was, like, even, like, a lot of people, I think, were, you know, not... Like, I've been in and out of a few different, like, rental places, and all my friends have rented different places. And sometimes you come and say, do you know if a DIF licence? Do you know if your landlord has one? And...
But do you know what the percentage payment was? What the actual... what the average number or the percentage number of people who paid their licence fee was pre-scandal?
I don't have a figure on me. There was something in the Indo about the kind of the amount of revenue that came in before. I think they're saying that already the losses... RTE reported losses of, like, 60 million, I want to say. Of evasion of the fee. And obviously that is now worse again. So it was already kind of in a deficit. There was already a loss there.
But as I understand it, this is a stopgap. Is that right?
I think this is to kind of stop that happening. So they can take whatever they do get, but then it's supplemented. But then I think the problem with involving like that, the exchequer or kind of having a taxpayer fund, is that that does have to be open to other broadcasters as well, which then means that the pot is just being divvied up a little bit further. So it's a risk as well in trying to create a hybrid. But, you know, if it's going to make up for losses by evasion of payment, then it kind of has to be done, because genuinely, what else can they do to keep it afloat?
I get the sense this isn't going to be the last time we discuss this.
Probably not.
Saoirse, thank you. Saoirse Hanley, features writer with The Independent. Likewise, thank you very much to Tanya Ward, Children's Rights Alliance Chief Executive.
The Anton Savage Show
with Kiri's.ie
on News Talk.